The Guardian.
The Guardian has partnered with audible.co.uk to offer listeners a free audiobook when you sign up for a one-month, no-commitment trial of the Audible service. Audible has over 50,000 audiobook titles available to download. Go to guardian.co.uk/audible for further details.
Hello, this is Science Weekly. I'm Alok Jha. On the show this week...
When a teacher says to them, you know, I need you to sit still here for 5 minutes, and the rest of us may think, 5 minutes, that doesn't seem that long. To that child, that genuinely might seem like an hour.
Writer and broadcaster Claudia Hammond explores the science of time and why we all experience it so differently. And...
I would probably say to non-geeks, try and discover the geek inside you. I think we all have a little bit.
We celebrate geeks inner and outer with science writers Angela Saini and Mark Henderson, ahead of their debate at the Bristol Ideas Festival. We'll also discuss some of this week's science issues, including a lack of women scientists in the UK and the very latest machinations in the debate for open access to scientific research. This is Science Weekly from The Guardian. The interview I'm about to play you now will last exactly 12 minutes and 9 seconds. However, for some of you it'll feel longer, for some, shorter. Why this happens is the subject of Claudia Hammond's Time Warped, Unlocking the Mysteries of Time Perception. Guardian science correspondent Ian Sample met with Claudia to discuss the book. He started by asking her why she got interested in trying to understand time in the first place.
I wrote a book before about emotions, and when I was looking at the research, I noticed that quite a lot of the stuff on emotions often seemed to touch on time perception and how we looked at time passing, and that got me interested in that and about ideas of the future. And then I was thinking, well, shall I write about ideas of the future, how it is that we can hold an idea of the future in mind in a way that no other animal seems to be able to do? And then I thought, no, I'll go for the whole of time instead, and we'll look at memory and the past and how we hold the past and the future in mind, how it is that we can mentally time travel, and why it is that time does all these strange things all the time that we never quite get used to, that it warps in strange ways.
Before we get into too much of this, let's do this little experiment with the listeners where they can decide for themselves about when a meeting is changed and what that might tell them about how they perceive time themselves. Can you lay out the question?
Yeah, so if I said to you, you had a meeting that's booked for Wednesday, but that the meeting needs to be moved forward 2 days, what day would the meeting be now?
Okay.
So the meeting's on a Wednesday, but it's moved forward 2 days. What day is it now?
Okay, so we'll let the listeners think about that while we carry on. We'll come back to that at the end, see what people make of it and what on earth that means. Claudia, take us through how we actually sense time. Is it something we just infer from what we observe in the world? We see stuff changing, and from that we deduce that there is time changing. How do we sense it?
Well, what's curious is that the mind seems to create its own construction of time, if you like. You know, we know time is out there, and I'm not looking at the physics of time, but this subjective experience of how does time feel as though it's passing now. And what is extraordinary is that we're really good at sensing 30 seconds or a minute. People can do it fairly accurately, or even 3 hours. You know, we do know what 3 hours feels like, and we do know what a day feels like, and yet we also have this sense of the years going back before us and even an idea of the centuries before we were even born. We can hold all these different time frames in mind at a time. And it seems that what happens is that the mind constructs its own perceptions of time based on several things. And one is the emotions that you're feeling at the time. So many people will have had the experience, and certainly I had this when I had a car accident, of time absolutely slowing down if you're really convinced you might be about to die. And the car accident I had, I was fine in the end, probably took, I don't know, 20 seconds, something like that. But I would swear it was a good 5-10 minutes. I mean, it just seemed like forever. And I thought about so many things going on, and I had that really strong sense of time slowing down. And many people who've been in those sorts of life-threatening situations will report that. So emotions are one of the things that seems to really strongly affect our perception of how that time is passing.
And what are the other kinds of things that can affect our perception of time, make it go faster or slower?
Attention makes a big difference. Whether we're paying attention to time itself, if you're really bored and you're queuing, say, then you're paying attention to time itself and time will seem to slow down. There's some odd ones like rejection. There's a really quite unkind experiment where they get a load of people in a room, get them all to get to know each other and talk to each other and ask each other a few everyday questions. And then they ask people to put down the names of a couple of people they'd like to work with next. And unbeknown to them, they're fiddling this, and they call people in one at a time and tell them that unfortunately this has never happened before and they're really embarrassed about it, but no one has put them down to work with them. And then they say it'd be better if they worked on their own. They tell the other half of the people that they're so popular that everyone put down they wanted to work with them, so it's only fair if they work on their own. So, and then you've got all these people working on their own, and the first test they give them is a test of time perception, and they have to guess how long it takes for a minute to pass. And for the people who are feeling rejected and wondering why it is that everybody hates them and all these strangers don't like them, time really does slow down. For the ones who are popular, it goes nice and fast because they're happy and they're thinking, God, everyone likes me. This is nice, isn't it? So rejection is another strange one that seems to slow it down. And so is a high temperature is a really strange one. So there was this guy called Hudson Hoagland, who was a psychologist back in the 20s, and his wife had flu one day, and he decided, as any good psychologist should, that this would be a good opportunity to do an experiment on her, because whenever he left the room to go and get her something, to go and get her a glass of water, she complained that he'd been away for ages, and he swore that he really hadn't. So he got her to, kept repeatedly getting her to guess when a minute had passed, and he noted down what she said, and meanwhile he took her temperature. And he did this more than 30 times, and somehow she put up with this, even though she had flu. And then he did find that the higher her temperature was, the more time seemed to slow down for her. And this is something that has been confirmed since. So there's some really strange things that seem to slow it down.
There's a great example, actually, in your book about how fear changes how people can perceive time. Can you take us through that?
Alan Johnston was the BBC journalist who was held hostage in Gaza for 4 months. And of course, he had no idea it was only going to be 4 months. It could have been years and years, or you know, worse things could have happened. And there was one night where it went particularly slowly for him because he had a radio and he heard on the World Service that he'd been executed. This report obviously turned out not to be correct, but he heard this story and he thought that they must have released the news early and that basically they must be going to come and kill him that night. So for him, the hours and hours of that night, every single time he heard the slightest noise, he thought, this is it, now they've come to kill me, which will, you know, fit in with their press release. And so for him, time absolutely changed for him. It slowed right down.
And is that because the fear was making him sort of hyper-attentive to things, so he would be forming more memories or something?
So it seems to be that fear and very strong emotions like that will actually change your perception of time passing, that what seems to happen is that the clock is actually slowed down by that happening. However this mental clock is working, emotions we know have a very strong effect on it. So if you show people a video of an armed robbery that's scary and a video of a river, they'll think that the video of the armed robbery took longer, because they're slightly scared while they're watching it, and the emotions seem to change the speed of that clock, the speed of the pulses that we're counting up, if you like.
Why should that be? Why should this great variety of things affect our time perception? And is there any sense that we benefit from that in any sense, that it's a kind of evolutionary benefit or anything like that?
Well, it seems to be that there are various theories about how it is that our brains might actually be counting time, and nobody's managed to find a single dedicated clock in the brain. That's what everyone would like to be able to find. Now, obviously, there is the clock that controls your 24-hour, you know, circadian rhythms, but there's no clock that seems to be able to count to 30 seconds. There's no clock that can guess 2 hours, and yet we can do it. And there are various theories about, maybe there's a whole series of clocks for different durations of time, something that helps you detect milliseconds and something that helps you guess when hours have gone by. Or is the brain actually counting its own processes that are going on for other reasons? Maybe there is no dedicated clock, and what it's doing is actually counting the firing of neurons that's going on anyway. So these could be firing for any reason, like, you know, recognizing faces or something else that's going on. If that's the case, then this firing of neurons might change when different things happen, like, for example, if you've got a temperature, or if you start paying attention to time itself, or if memory can also affect time as well. So then these processes seem to slightly change, and the neurons might fire at different rates, and we might then count those at different rates, and then we think different time frames have passed.
Mm. You talk in the book about how sort of glitches or abnormal perceptions of time can feed into almost mental health issues or behavioural issues. Can you just take us through some of that? That seems extraordinary.
Yes, it's really interesting that people who are suffering from depression, and particularly people who are feeling suicidal, will describe time passing very, very slowly. And if you test this in a lab, their time perception has slowed down. They do believe that those minutes and hours and days are really, really dragging, that they have changed like that. Some people with schizophrenia find that their time perception becomes very skewed in all sorts of different directions. It can sometimes seem like it's going faster, sometimes seem like it's going slower. There are some curious things, like people with... children with Tourette's are particularly good at perceiving millisecond timeframes and will get these very accurately compared with other children. And particularly the children who are very good at suppressing the tics that are associated with Tourette's when people find themselves, you know, uncontrollably swearing or words coming out or, you know, their arms sort of flinging out. And the children that are better at suppressing it are even better at time estimation. And this seems to be because the milliseconds in particular seem to be assessed possibly by the prefrontal cortex, which is the area of the brain right at the very front, just behind the forehead. And when children are actively trying to suppress their tics, this area becomes very active. So it's almost as if they've honed that area so well in trying to suppress their tics that they actually become better at time perception as well, which is really quite curious. Mm. And children with ADHD, attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, again, time seems to go very slowly for them. So when a teacher says to them, you know, I need you to sit still here for 5 minutes, and the rest of us may think 5 minutes, that doesn't seem that long. To that child, that genuinely might seem like an hour. They do seem to have differing time perception.
Let's come back to this question we asked the listeners to think about at the beginning here, where there's a meeting on a Wednesday and you get an email saying we're going to move the meeting forward by 2 days. And your answer to that question tells you something about how you perceive time. What's going on there?
So there is no right or wrong answer. So the answer is either Monday or the answer is Friday. And you will find that this does cause confusion with people. And if you ask people this question, they'll often say, particularly the Monday people, will often say, oh, I always get this wrong. I always get this wrong. And people say they moved the meeting and I thought they were bringing it nearer. And if it turns out they were bringing it further away. So this has been used in lots of studies, this question. If you say it's Monday, this is known as the time-moving metaphor. And the idea is that you see time as moving towards you. So it's the difference between saying, we're coming up to Christmas, or Christmas is coming. Is it Christmas that's getting nearer to you while you stay still, or are you heading off towards Christmas? If you give the Friday answer, it's known as the ego-moving metaphor, and it means that you see yourself as moving through time and that you're sort of sailing off through it. It will change slightly, so people will have one preference or other, but it will change, for example, if they're at the end of a train journey or the beginning of a train journey, whether they feel themselves moving through time or not, will slightly change. And what it tells us is how it is that people are quite fundamental in a way about how they're seeing themselves in relation to time, whether it is them that's moving or is it time? Do we just sit here and time just comes towards us? And the people who feel that time comes towards them can sometimes be the same people who feel they are slightly less in control and that events are in control of them because the time is coming. Whatever you do, the time is coming towards you.
And if people do feel out of control that way, is there anything they can do? Can they try and see things differently, or is it something
ingrained? It would be interesting. You could deliberately decide to use, you know, techniques of visual imagery to decide, I'm going to see myself powering forwards into the future. And it partly depends on whether you're dreading or optimistically anticipating the future.
Are you doing any more work in this area?
I think time is fascinating. So I will definitely carry on looking at time because I'm obsessed with it now. So,
Claudia, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Time Warped, Unlocking the Mysteries of Time Perception, is published by Canongate and is available at all good bookshops. We're all very proud geeks on this podcast. We love discussing and promoting the brilliant ideas of rationalism, science, and evidence. But how far should we geeks go in trying to get our way of thinking out into the rest of the non-geeky world? What about those people in society who just don't have much time or interest in science or evidence? Mark Henderson, former science editor of The Times in London, thinks geeks need to start getting out and campaigning. They need to spread their message and their way of thinking to the highest echelons of power, he says, in his new book, The Geek Manifesto. Supporting his aims is science writer Angela Saini. She's also a self-confessed geek and author of Geek Nation, which catalogues the rise of science in India. Both of them came into the studio to talk about the power that geeks have to make the world a better place. It's also a very current issue. In the next session of the UK Parliament, the government's going to introduce a bill to reform Britain's draconian libel laws. The bill itself began as a campaign by the geek supporters of science writer Simon Singh, who was sued by chiropractors in 2008 for daring to suggest that chiropractic had no evidence to support its medical claims. I began by asking Mark Henderson to tell me more about that campaign.
Well, it's a great example, I think, of actually how people who care deeply about something and who care deeply about the values of science can actually start to make a difference. What happened here was, first of all, Simon Singh was sued for libel over a piece that he wrote in The Guardian about chiropractors and how they were claiming to be able to treat all kinds of things for which there was no evidence, colicky babies, that kind of thing. The chiropractors, rather than kind of rebutting that with evidence, decided to sue him, and it wasn't actually such a bad decision on the face of it. The libel laws here are very friendly to claimants, and there was every chance that simply because of the costs of defending libel that Simon would have to back down, would have to apologise and so on. But actually he kept going. One of the main reasons he kept going and fought the case was because he got this incredible groundswell of support from geeks, from people out there who care deeply about science, about the free inquiry and the spirit of being able to ask any questions, to challenge any evidence that actually is one of the foundations of science. They blogged about it. They went to meetings about it. They campaigned on Twitter and Facebook. And while that didn't necessarily actually have a direct effect on the legal process, what it really did was it kept Simon's spirits up. It left him in a position where actually he was happy to fight on, and he felt it was desperately important to fight on. And actually, aided by a very good legal team, he won the case. The chiropractors actually had to pull out after a particularly key judgment in Simon's favour. What I think was then key was that it didn't stop there. This Keep Libel Laws Out of Science petition that was organised by Sense About Science then coalesced into a much bigger political movement that lobbied politicians, successfully got the case for libel reform onto the manifestos of all three main parties at the last election. And here we are now actually with a bill that's about to be presented.
So the bill is going to be presented in this next session of Parliament. It will look to increase public interest defence for scientists, journalists and others. It's a landmark rule. Now, what in terms of how seriously the UK Parliament takes scientists, geeks, whatever you want to call them, to paint us a picture of the situation as it stands. I mean, we talked already a few weeks ago about scientific advice in Parliament. I mean, that's not kind of what I'm talking about here. It's more about how are scientists seen by politicians and MPs as part of their daily constituency activity or elsewhere?
Well, I think by and large they aren't. It's worth actually just stopping for a moment to look at the composition of the House of Commons at the moment. There are 650 MPs. There's 138 who have a background in business, 90 who have a background in professional politics, and 86 who have a background in the law. There is one professional scientist in the House of Commons, Julian Huppert from Cambridge. Now, The narrow technical expertise that comes with being a scientist is usually neither here nor there in politics. That's not why I think it's important that actually we have more people with a grounding in science in there. It's much more the approach to thinking and decision making that being grounded in science actually brings. And also, I think, a knowledge and understanding of actually what it is to do science at the moment. And I think what happens is this paucity of that grounding in our political system leads to two different types of policy errors. The first one is when it comes to actually the management of science, the way that science is funded and regulated. And again and again, you get decisions being made that really sort of don't actually take into account the effect that would actually have on science. So in funding, for example, you get cuts tend to be directed at early stage scientists, which ends up disrupting the flow, the pipeline of talent into the system, which you can't turn on and off. You've then got regulatory issues, something like the immigration cap that was brought in, where the specific limit was around salary. It was, the idea was, in order to discriminate on getting talented people in, you'd look at how much they were paid.
This was the immigration cap proposed by the coalition government when they came in 2010 that would restrict the number of people coming to the UK. It was more of a political sort of political move, which had unintended consequences for science.
Well, that's right. It actually had the de facto effect of making it almost impossible for particularly scientists at a junior level to come into the UK from outside the European Union. And I mean, anybody who knew anything about how science actually works would know two things. First of all, that science is increasingly an international game, where we need to attract talent from India, from China, places like that. And secondly, that scientists aren't paid that much, and you can't use talent as that kind of discriminatory factor. The second kind of policy error is actually about the political use of science. Now, we talked recently about science advice, so I won't go into that too much here. But actually, science doesn't only matter in politics, where there is a sort of body of knowledge that needs to be contributed to decision making through an advisory process. It also matters desperately where, in fact, we don't know the answers. If we're talking about questions such as, well, how do we best teach our children to read? What are the school structures that work best? What are the approaches to perhaps sentencing drugs offenders that might do most to combat recidivism? And what tends to happen in politics is the politician comes up with a solution and then casts around for some evidence to support that, or very often doesn't even bother with that. What we ought to be doing is actually taking that scientific approach to knowledge, the method that says we develop a hypothesis and then we put it to the test. We look actively for evidence when we don't know so that we can find out. We need to be doing that much more in public policy. And I don't think that that's something that really occurs to politicians nearly enough. And that's where I think having more people who are trained in science would help. But one of the reasons that would help is I think it would help to lift the game of the politicians around them as well. To actually, if there was a sort of cadre of people in the House of Commons who really are grounded properly, who have this affinity for science, it would bring that extra voice to those political discussions, saying, why don't we go away and experiment? Why don't we test this?
Angela, Mark describes a situation there where Parliament, takes what it wants from science whenever it needs it, but kind of isn't taken too seriously in the day to day. How do we get into a situation? Whose fault is it? Is it politicians not being interested enough in science, or is it scientists' fault for not pushing science in the face of those people?
Well, I think to some extent it's politics. You know, that's how politics works. You take the information that you want, you're selective about it in order to, you know, feed your values and your agenda. So when I was reading the Geek Manifesto, I did think, I loved the book. It was really a wonderful read, and it collected together lots of disparate stuff from all over the place, not just the Simon Singh example, but lots of things that have happened over the last decade or so, like the MMR vaccine, for example. But I did think that maybe, I think sometimes the reason scientists get frustrated with politicians is because politics is not an easy world to be in. You don't start with thinking we want to get at the truth. You start with we have an agenda that we want to achieve, and how can we achieve that? So the aims are kind of different, and I think that's partly to blame. Mm. Yeah.
So whose fault is it? I mean, again, in this false dichotomy kind of way, but you know, you can argue that politicians have their agendas, and that's what they're there to do. But are enough scientists taking responsibility for the fact that maybe they're not engaging enough with the politicians? I mean, this is a theme in Mark's book. We'll come to it, but
yeah, I mean, there's a culture difference, isn't there? Scientists don't like sometimes engaging.
How can
with
you
the rest
expect politicians to know this stuff if someone's not telling them, right?
No, that's true. And but you know, it's a part of the politician as well to go to scientists and say, "Can you give me advice on this? Can you help me with this?" And you know, getting more rigor into policy is also really the job of social scientists. I mean, that's what policy is about. It's about applying things to the real world in social situations. And social sciences have become more rigorous over the years. The problem is that there is a huge divide between the social sciences and the sciences. Scientists are very skeptical and suspicious of what happens in the social sciences. And in some sense, there are a lot of people who believe that you can't apply the same rules of science to policy because the real world just doesn't work in the way the physical world works. So there are these kind of tensions and problems. And I mean, I don't want to blame politicians entirely. There is a problem that we don't have enough scientists in the House of Commons. That is sad, and I'm sure that's part of the reason that we have the situation that we do. But also, they're kind of incompatible, science and politics, in some sense. Getting to a place where they are compatible, I think, is the big barrier. I don't know how we're going to overcome that.
Mark, is the solution to have more scientists in Parliament, would that risk the reverse problem, perhaps, of saying, well, actually, so shouldn't scientists be doing science stuff? Why would they want to go into Parliament?
Well, I think it would help to have a few more scientists in politics. But just to go back on something that Angela said, where actually I agree with her to a large extent, there is a big difference between science and politics. And of course, politicians are going to bring their values, their manifestos, all those sorts of things into play. And there's actually nothing wrong with that. And something I say, I think, I hope very clearly in the book is that I'm not saying that science, that rigorous evidence is always the only factor that needs to be brought into play. It's usually necessary, but it's very rarely sufficient for informed decision making. The problem is that very often when the politicians sort of do this kind of thing, they act as if they're doing things based on science, based on evidence, when actually they're not. They're not actually upfront about the fact that they're following ideology or something that's for political advantage.
And why is that, do you think? I mean, is there still a respect for science, even if you don't want to use it?
Yeah, there is. There is. Science has a kind of authority. And I think a lot of politicians see it as a kind of magic dust.
Yeah, and we love statistics, don't we? I mean, that's the thing. Numbers are so powerful, and politicians know that.
Absolutely. And I mean, you see that all the time. Politicians love to quote statistics, not always the best statistics or even open statistics. There's a great example of this actually just recently when Damien Green, the immigration minister, came to the House of Commons and in order to explain the crisis that's happening at Heathrow Airport at the moment with a huge long queues in the immigration because of shortage of staff and so on. And he was quoting figures, latest figures, saying actually it's not nearly as bad as everybody's saying. But those figures were unpublished, and that's actually pretty much a cardinal sin from a scientific point of view to make your argument based on data that nobody else can challenge because they can't see it.
Well, it's a classic politician's ruse, though, isn't it? To not publish things or publish things straight after. So here you have a misapplication of data. What did you call it in the book? It's policy-based evidence.
Well, that's right. Yeah, politicians say they want to make evidence-based policy, but really what they're really after is policy-based evidence, evidence that tells them to do what they wanted to do anyway.
But also, there's a time lag there. I mean, the process of science is so slow, and checking things is so slow, and when you know, when you have a term in government, you kind of have to do things quickly, and sometimes, that's another stumbling.
Things have to move faster than scientific checking can do. That's absolutely correct, Angela. In your book, Geek Nation, which is about science, the status of science in India, was published last year. Tell us about the position of the geeks in that country, which is an emerging nation. It's got lots of potential on the international scene. How is science engineering seen in that country?
You know, it's weird. I was just talking to some Indian geeks the other day, and young Indian geeks, because older Indian geeks don't actually know the word geek. I had to explain it to a lot of them. But India is such a geeky country that to them, it's quite normal. You know, science is not in the rigorous way that Mark talks about in his book, in kind of challenging policy and getting really good statistics, but in a kind of cultural sense, science is a part of everyday life, technology is a part of everyday life, and people love it. So it's interesting to look at, you know, to compare, I've lived in the UK all my life, to compare this society where science is kind of not really mainstream, it's still something kind of on the margins, in a sense, with India, where science is really a part of everyday life, and it's valued and it's loved and it's celebrated, and that made it a wonderful place to journey through.
What about in Parliament and in the courts, for example? How is science, is the situation reflected in those institutions in India?
See, that's the odd thing. Ever since independence, India has never had a government that hasn't been pro-science. So there's always been lots of funding, or as much funding as India can afford, and there's always been lots of support. And in fact, weirdly, India is a very spiritual, religious country, but some of the most religious states are also some of the most pro-science. So there aren't the same tensions that you get in the rest of the world. It's kind of weird that way. There are, however, other tensions. So in their love of science and in their kind of pursuit of using science to improve everyday lives for ordinary Indians, you do get odd abuses of science. And one example I talk about in the book is the lie detector. So there are some states in India where forensic labs are now using this kind of strange, very unscientific lie detector based on brain scans to judge whether murder suspects are telling the truth. And it's a technology that scientists in India have discredited and said they shouldn't be using. But politicians love science so much and so have so much faith in this technology that they keep using it. The interesting thing about India was that because it is a very poor country and because from the very early days the social aspects of science have always been so important, scientists really engage with the people around them. They have to, because they're trying to create research and technologies that help them. And so there's much more of an interplay between ordinary people and scientists. Whereas sometimes I feel in the UK that scientists just don't care what people think of them, or, you know, just don't have an interest in talking to them.
Is creating what Mark calls a geek vote a solution to that?
It's an interesting one. I mean, you just stop short of mentioning block voting in your book, but it'll be interesting. Could we have a scientific vote like the Green Party or like other smaller parties? Would that work? I don't know.
The vote for OAPs or the gay vote.
Countryside
Alliance. It's just another lobby. Mark, isn't that a problem in some respects? Because then it makes science into a fringe. Well, it's not a fringe, but it makes it into a special interest group that can be ignored.
I'm very sceptical of the idea that there should be a science party or a sort of single issue a group on that front. But what I do think would be helpful would be two things. The first thing is for non-political groupings, such as the Campaign for Science and Engineering and Sense About Science, to actually become bigger and more engaged lobbying organizations that can actually campaign on specific policies where it's really important that a scientific viewpoint is held. And the second thing is, I think that scientists and geeks who value science ought to get much more involved in the political process. If you have a strong party affiliation, for example, then why not join that party and try to influence its candidate selection, for example? If one of the candidates in your constituency who you perhaps might normally support, who perhaps might be standing for the party you normally back, is terrible on scientific issues, don't vote for them and make sure that people know why you're not voting for them. I think it's that kind of tactics. And I mean, I make the analogy, and it's by no means perfect, and I really don't want to overdo it, but with the way that gay politics has developed over the last 30 years. Now, I really don't want to suggest that being a geek is the same as being gay, because it's just not. But actually, if you look at the tactics and the way in which the gay community has successfully reached a point where political candidates have to have a thought-through position on issues that they care about, that's really something we should be striving for.
Why don't we finish up with some guidance for geeks and wannabe geeks from the both of you. What's your one thing that these newly empowered geeks should be doing, Mark?
If I can have two things.
First thing for geeks to do is to request double the amount you're given. That's his tip.
Absolutely. It would in some ways be much easier for the government to justify doubling the science budget than having it stand still, because that gives them a narrative and agenda. But just to those things that geeks should do. The first thing I would really encourage people to do is to engage actively with their own MP. You are a constituent. Your MP is your representative. If you write to them, if you go along to your constituency surgery, you actually have a chance of being heard and of influencing them. The second thing I would urge people to do is, if you really care about these kinds of issues, join one of the lobby groups that is campaigning on them. Campaign for Science and Engineering, Sense About Science, perhaps Women in Science and Engineering. These groups can be more powerful if they have more members.
Angela?
I agree with that. I would probably say to non-geeks, try and discover the geek inside you. I think we all have a little bit, and I think it would help to stop geeks being so cliquey and maybe make geekiness more mainstream.
Let's talk now about some of this week's science and technology news. Mark Henderson and Angela Saini are both here with us still. Angela, start with you. Women in science. Apparently, the UK is 50 years behind the US when it comes to women in science. Is that true?
I haven't got the statistics to prove that, but this is what Professor Leslie Yellerlees has been saying. She's going to become very shortly the Royal Society of Chemistry's first female president, which is something to celebrate.
So some provocative words from her.
Very provocative. Well, I do think women scientists in high-profile positions kind of, whether they like it or not, have to take up the mantle of encouraging women to science and kind of pushing this agenda, because there are so few women in science in the UK, and it is depressing, and the situation, even though it's improving, is improving so slowly that it almost makes what she says true, because there are so few of them. And in the US, there does seem to be, I mean, there are more just in terms of numbers because the population is so big. I don't think proportionally it's there's a huge amount of difference, but there are some things better about the American system. And there are kind of groups and efforts being made to push more women to science there that don't seem to be happening here.
The UK has two quite prominent groups that are who lobby on behalf of women in science, the UKRC and WISE, which was mentioned earlier, Women in Science and Engineering. Both groups don't have any money from government anymore. They were
and
both funded by
government.
Actually
a joint group now. Oh, I just learned that yesterday. Yeah. WISE has been taken over.
This says something about the position or the importance of this, that the government doesn't feel like it's important enough to fund this. That can't have been a positive thing for the cause last year when this was decided last year, as part of the wider funding cuts.
No, it's pretty depressing. And in fact, Professor Yellerlees did say in her big statement about women in science that Michelle Obama went to speak at AWISE, which is the American equivalent of WISE. At the same time, UKRC and WISE has lost all its government funding, and it's kind of desperate now for corporate funding or, you know, from other sources, universities or institutes, which is pretty awful, really. I mean, how is it that the US, which is in just as bad an economic state as we are, is able to recognize that encouraging more women to science is an economic good, is a social good, and something to be supported right from the top, while in the UK, it hardly seems to be on the agenda at all.
Mark, do you recognise this picture that Professor Yellerlees is describing?
Well, I do. It's a terribly difficult topic because so much of this is historical. The Royal Society got a lot of flack recently when its new fellows were announced, and I think there were 3 out of 44 were women. But actually, if you look at the Royal Society over the last 10 years, about 10% of science and technology professors in the UK are women, and about 10% of their new fellows have been women over the last 10 years. So hopefully it's a blip, but it's very difficult to do. something that has happened that was quite positive in this respect recently was Sally Davis, who's the chief medical officer, recently announced that actually for medical schools, the research arms of medical schools to get continued funding from the National Institute for Health Research, that they would now have to meet minimum standards on the career provisions that they introduced for women in science. So that's probably a positive step, at least, but we're not nearly where we should be.
Yeah, and it's not just a cultural thing. It's not just, I mean, I think good work is being done at the school level to encourage more women to take up science and engineering. But the problem comes, I think, maybe later when they choose to have a family. It's devastating to a research career to take a year or two out to start a family. You just can't do that and maintain the same level of competitiveness as your colleagues. And if you want flexible working, yes, research is flexible, but the hours are really long. So it's still not really conducive to having a family. And I've spoken to dozens and dozens of women, not just in the UK, all over the world, who have chosen deliberately not to have children just so they can get ahead in their scientific careers, which is a tragedy.
I think it can be a particular problem too, because the way in which early career science is now structured is basically a series of really quite short-term contracts. And that is really difficult to combine with planning a family life.
Let's move on to another subject which has been very close to my heart in the last few weeks. It wouldn't be a podcast without mentioning open access at least once. Mark, the latest on this is that there's been lots of coverage on the blogosphere and elsewhere, and other newspapers, of course. David Willetts, the science minister for the UK, has come out strongly in favour of open access for all government-funded research, in a speech to the Publishers Association. So quite a big challenge there. Mind you, there are columnists in the Times recently, your former employer, talking about how actually the open access case might be risking destroying an industry. So it's complicated. I mean, there are lots of sides to this. What do you give us your update on open access of late?
Sure. Before I start, I should mention that my current employer is the Wellcome Trust, which obviously is very committed to open access. But so David Whiten, who's a former colleague I respect greatly, wrote a piece recently suggesting that this could have a very negative impact on a successful publishing industry, and it could. He made, I think, though, two arguments that I'm not sure are quite correct. First of all, he suggested that the argument that, well, the taxpayer funds this research, therefore the end user shouldn't have to pay for it, is misleading. And the analogy he made was with the Olympic Games. So the taxpayer is funding the Olympic Games, but we still expect the people who are going to the Olympic Games to pay for tickets. I think that's the wrong analogy, because tickets are used to manage demand, and obviously the people who go to the Olympics at the end of the day get a huge amount of personal value out of that. Not quite the same as for science. A much better analogy is actually the Olympic Games on television. Now, the Olympic Games will be free to air on the BBC, and that's actually what we get partly for our taxpayers' money there. The analogy is actually with the Olympic Games being on Sky, where you have to pay for it at the end of the day. And I think if that were to happen, there would be quite a big public outcry about it. The other issue, of course, is the international nature of this. David Whiten's criticism was that if the UK were to press ahead with open access and paying for author fees rather than subscription fees, well, we don't publish all the science in the world, and we'll still have to pay those subscription fees to read about what's happening elsewhere. But actually, this is an international trend. And if you look at the US, you have some of the big funders there, the National Institutes of Health, the Howard Hughes Medical Institute, are also very committed to open access. I do agree with him that this is something that needs to be tackled internationally, but I also think that is happening.
David Willetts himself has mentioned this as part of the government's policy on this, or developing policy on this, that international agencies will need to look at this, and perhaps the UK could take a lead. I mean, which is, it's not such a bad position to be in if you're a British scientist. Angela, what are your thoughts on this? Open access, good, bad?
Well, I'm a journalist, and I do actually write news and features for some international journals, so I'm biased on this one because they pay my wages.
You've declared your interest, but go on.
So I have no interest in them losing money. But I do have to say, some of these journals, especially the bigger ones, offer a service that goes beyond just publication. They organise conferences. They they don't just publish journal articles, they also publish features, and they put huge amounts of resources into that, and they produce images, and I would not want to see that being lost, because I think it's such an important and vital resource. And if it were just up to publicly funded bodies to do that, then it would be a shame. I don't actually have a moral problem with people making money out of publishing journals, because as long as their profit margins aren't ridiculously high and unfairly high, then and they offer a good service, then I'm okay with that.
I'd agree. There's no moral argument against publishers making a profit out of this. And actually, it's quite clear there is a cost to the scientific publication process, and somebody has to pay that cost. The big question is who, and certainly our argument at the Wellcome Trust, and I think David Willetts' argument, is that that should increasingly be the funders of research, in that this is seen actually as an integral part of the costs of doing research. Mark Wolpert, the director of the Wellcome Trust, says publication is as much part of the cost of research as buying a centrifuge is, and it needs to be seen like that. So actually, you're paying for it at the outset rather than at the user end, where the paywall barriers to research can be a huge disincentive to you as a journalist as well. You must have had issues where you were trying to get hold of an article and it was going to cost 50 quid.
As a journalist, you get free media access to most journal articles. So,
though you do sometimes have to wait quite a long time.
Yeah, you do. That's very true. And it is annoying to have to put in a request every time you want to read something. So I can understand it on that front. And also, you know, there are a lot of developing world scientists for whom the cost of accessing journals is huge, and it's very unfair that they have to do that. So if there is some middle ground out there, I'd love to know what it is, because it would make science fairer.
It's interesting too, you raised also the kind of added value that the journals produce, the kind of features and the conferences and that sort of thing. And yeah, absolutely, they do add value. But actually, that's the sort of thing where I think it's totally legitimate to charge the end user of that. In a way, if you look at Nature, the flagship British-based science journal, they've kind of almost got their subscription the wrong way round. The free-to-air stuff is the news and features and the stuff where actually they could be selling that. And the stuff you have to pay hefty charges for is the science.
You're dangerously close to charging for journalism there, Mark, which is something we don't approve of in this institution.
unless you're at the time.
Mark and Angela, thank you both very much indeed. For more on all this stuff, you can go to guardian.co.uk/science. Thanks to Mark Henderson and Angela Saini. You can catch both of them at the Festival of Ideas in Bristol on the 19th of May. For more information on their talk called In Defence of Geeks, go to ideasfestival.co.uk. You'll also find that link and more on our blog. That's all we have for this edition of Science Weekly. You can keep up to speed with breaking science news at any time, of course, on guardian.co.uk/science. But from me, Alok Jha, and Science Weekly producer Jason Phipps, it's goodbye.
The Guardian has partnered with audible.co.uk to offer listeners a free audiobook when you sign up for a one-month, no-commitment trial of the Audible service. Audible has over 50,000 audiobook titles available to download. Go to guardian.co.uk/audible for further details.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.